be with the fourth case of the morning, which is Jeremy Armstrong versus Daniel Bertrand. Ms. Kuchelski?
May it please the court. My name is Angela Kuchelski, and with co-counsel Robin Fellow, we represent petitioner Jeremy Armstrong. Mr. Armstrong was denied his right to due process when the trial court excluded polygraph evidence at his suppression hearing. Jeremy Armstrong was 15 years old when he was charged with first-degree intentional homicide. He was arrested, he was questioned, and eventually gave a statement. At the time he was questioned, Jeremy testified that the officer told him that he was young, that he would be well-liked in prison, that he would be put in a pretzel position in prison, that he would be raped. The detective put his hands on Jeremy's throat and also told Jeremy that if he didn't talk, or if he did talk, they would ensure that he did not go to prison. We filed a suppression motion where we claimed that the statement was coerced. But because it was Jeremy's word versus the detective's word, Jeremy took a polygraph examination. And that examination asked him questions about whether or not the detective had made those statements and whether or not the detective had put his hands on Jeremy's neck. Jeremy passed the polygraph. We then moved to have the polygraph results admitted at the suppression hearing. The trial court excluded the polygraph evidence and ruled that under the per se ban on polygraph evidence set forth in State versus Dean, that the results would not be admitted.
Wasn't there other evidence of what happened other than this confession, though? I mean, is the confession very crucial to the showing here?
Was the confession crucial to his conviction, Your Honor? Or
yeah.
Well, yes. At the trial, Jeremy Armstrong, we argued that he had a right to self-defense. The statement that he made did not have much self-defense in the statement. But as far as the suppression of the statement goes, it was crucial to show and to corroborate what Jeremy Armstrong, the 15-year-old defendant, said happened versus what the detective said.
Weren't there other witnesses?
To the statement, Your Honor, or to
the... No, to the occurrence.
To the occurrence, there was, yes. And there was evidence presented that would have supported self-defense. But as far as the statement goes and as far as whether or not it was coerced, the trial court, by excluding the polygraph evidence, basically...
So my point is, how important was the confession? That's what I'm trying to determine.
Confessions, Judge, I think are always important. It was important to the state. They admitted it. As far as the trial court's decision that the polygraph should not be admitted, the trial court ignored the fact that the state legislator had enacted 901.032, which is a statute that says that the Department of Corrections for sex offenders on probation or parole can require their probationers to take polygraph examinations. That enactment, which happened in 1997 right before our case, we're arguing overrules the per se ban set forth in State versus Dean. Dean was decided in 1981, and the reasoning behind the per se ban on polygraph evidence was first that the Wisconsin Supreme Court did not believe it was reliable. The court was also concerned, however, that allowing polygraph evidence into a jury trial would invade the fact-finding process of the jury and would also possibly confuse the jury, and the jury might place greater weight on the polygraph evidence. Those concerns do not apply in this case.
How does that compare with sex offenders taking polygraphs?
The statute that was enacted, Your Honor, allows the Department of Corrections to force a sex offender to take a polygraph.
Yeah, but that's... I'm sorry, that's when he's done some kind of conditional release and stuff, isn't it?
That's correct.
Isn't that part of a deterrent and other things? That has nothing to do with evidence, does it?
That's correct. However, State versus Dean says that there should be no polygraph evidence in any criminal proceedings. And subsequently, the Wisconsin Supreme Court in State versus Ramey held it could not be admissible in revocation proceedings. Then in 1997, when the legislature enacted 301.032, they allowed that as a condition of probation or parole, a sex offender can be forced to take a polygraph. If he refuses, that can be used against him as a violation of a condition and then used in his revocation. So we're arguing that that statute overrules the per se ban. Also, the trial court's decision is contrary to United States Supreme Court precedent, and specifically United States versus Sheffer. While it's true that Sheffer upheld a per se ban on polygraph evidence, especially under Military Rule 707, the court also held that individual jurisdictions can reach different conclusions as to whether polygraph evidence should be admitted. It's our argument that by enacting the Section 301.032, the legislature has overruled the per se ban, and therefore the trial court decision is contrary to United States versus Sheffer. Additionally, the district court found that that the petitioner had failed to establish that there was any United States Supreme Court case that has held that once any exception is made in a state statutory scheme, polygraph evidence must be admissible in a suppression hearing. There is no such narrow holding in any case. However, under United States versus Sheffer, the general ruling is that individual jurisdictions can make up their own rules. And in fact, many of the circuits have done so. They've many of the circuits, not all of them, but many, have ruled that there should not be a per se ban and that the district court should be allowed to evaluate the evidence, hold a Daubert-type hearing to determine whether or not it's reliable, and then the district court should be the ones to determine whether it should be admitted. In this case, we were not asking that the polygraph be admitted in any kind of jury proceeding. We were asking that it be admitted in the suppression hearing, where the judge would have been the fact finder. The judge would have had the ability to weigh the polygraph evidence. There would have been no risk of confusing a jury. Thus, the trial court, and because the trial court did not admit the polygraph evidence, that decision is contrary to United States versus Sheffer. The second issue we raise is whether or not the trial court's failure to give the jury instruction of self-defense violated Jeremy Armstrong's due process rights and his right to a fair trial. We also argued that it was an unreasonable application of United States Supreme Court precedent. Specifically, in Matthews versus United States, the Supreme Court held that as a general proposition, a defendant is entitled to an instruction as to any recognized defense for which there exists evidence sufficient for a reasonable jury to find in his favor. In this case, the trial court found there was insufficient evidence to give the self-defense instruction. However, there was ample evidence, and we have argued that in the trial court and here, for the self-defense instruction.
How was there ample evidence when he pulled the gun and pointed?
Yes, Your Honor, there is a question under Rupp versus State in Wisconsin. There, an armed gunman does not have a right for self-defense. But in this case, Jeremy Armstrong, again, he was a 15-year-old. The victim, Robert Drury, was his father's best friend and roommate. Jeremy would stay at his father's house. He would witness Robert Drury doing drugs. Robert Drury would tell him over and over again about his violent escapades, the people he had injured. He also told Jeremy about the weapons that he had stashed around the house where Jeremy stayed in and where this crime took place. When Jeremy, what happened on the day of the homicide is Robert Drury came back to that house. He had some money. He was flashing it in front of Jeremy. He actually hit him with it at one point. And then Jeremy did pull a gun and demand the money from Mr. Drury. At that point, Robert Drury laughed at him and said, "I'm going to kill you," a number of times. And then he lunged for the gun, and the gun went off. It is our position, and it was in the trial court and still remains our position, that Jeremy Armstrong, although he did have, was armed and was a gunman at the time, he did have a right to self-defense. Based on the history he had with this person, that evidence was presented at court, and the fact
he's holding a gun. In fact, the whole thing wouldn't have happened if he hadn't been holding the gun in the first place, right?
That's correct. That's correct. But, again, when Jeremy Armstrong pointed the gun, he was 15 years old, he's confronting this 40-year-old man that he knows is violent, that he knows there are weapons, that this man has told him there are weapons stashed around the room. At that point, the victim says, "I'm going to kill you," and then lunges for the gun. The gun goes off.
At the point where he tried to rob him after knowing all this about him, huh?
He did, yes. And he did admit to robbing him. The second aspect of the self-defense argument is that the trial court, when it gave the jury instructions to the jury, mistakenly left self-defense language in the jury instructions. That came to light because the jury asked, what does the privilege of self-defense mean, and does Jeremy Armstrong have a right to self-defense in committing this crime? At that time, We asked the trial court again for self-defense instruction. Obviously, the jury was concerned about it. They were asking about it. And the court again said to the jury they could not consider it. There was sufficient evidence for a self-defense instruction in this case, and the fact that the trial court did not give the self-defense instruction was an unreasonable application under Matthews versus United States. Finally, we've argued that statute sections 938.183 sub 2 and 938 sub 18 sub 5 are unconstitutional as applied to Jeremy Armstrong. I'd like to address the irrebuttable presumption argument that we've made.
Are you continuing with the vagueness argument on appeal?
I've argued it in the briefs. I will not be arguing it today in oral argument. But as to the irrebuttable presumption, Jeremy was 15 and charged with first-degree intentional homicide. In the state of Wisconsin, that means he started out in adult criminal court. After a finding of the lesser included of first-degree reckless homicide, there was then a question of whether or not he would be sentenced as an adult or a juvenile. One of the things that the trial court must look at when making that determination is a list of criteria set forth in 938.18 sub 5, and specifically subsection B, which states that the court must consider the type and seriousness of the offense, including whether it was against persons or property, the extent to which it was committed in a violent, aggressive, and premeditated or willful manner. It is our argument that no child, 15 or 16-year-old, who is charged with first-degree intentional homicide, who begins in the adult court and then is found guilty of a lesser-included offense of homicide, could ever rebut that statute section. They would have, in order to be eligible for juvenile disposition, the court would have to look at whether or not that was a serious offense. Obviously, homicide is a serious offense. It's an offense against persons, and even the lesser-included homicides would be committed in a violent, aggressive, and premeditated or willful manner. So therefore, we argue that that statute section is unconstitutional. For all these reasons, we ask this court to reverse the decision of the district court and to find that the decisions of the state court were contrary to United States Supreme Court precedent and unreasonable application of United States Supreme Court precedent. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Gansner?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is William Gansner. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Wisconsin. I represent the respondent, the appellee on this appeal. This appeal from the denial of Mr. Armstrong's petition for a writ of habeas corpus under section 2254. Jeremy Armstrong was 15 years old when he hatched a plan to commit a very adult crime. Having determined that his father's friend was a person that had a considerable amount of cash, he and some of his friends determined to confront Mr. Drury, the murder victim, and rob him. Midway through the completion of that crime, with a gun having been drawn by Jeremy Armstrong, and Jeremy having twice threatened the victim with the gun, having been told twice to hand over the money, the victim chose to defend himself. He lunged for the gun, and according to the facts that were found by the state court, Armstrong closed his eyes and fired the gun. Mr. Drury was killed. Armstrong then fled. He was fully conscious of what he had done. He attempted to conceal the weapon. He threw it away in a field. Later, realizing that he hadn't gotten the proceeds of the planned crime, the money, he went back, took the money from the dead Mr. Drury, left, decided to recover the gun from the field where he had thrown it, and then later in the day, his friends went to dinner and to an arcade. Though he was charged with first-degree intentional homicide, the highest degree offense for this crime under Wisconsin law, Mr. Armstrong, after a trial at which he himself testified to the facts I have just described, the facts that were found by the state courts, a jury found him guilty of the lesser offense of first-degree reckless homicide, for which he was sentenced to 20 years in prison instead of the mandatory life term he could have received had he been convicted of the greater offense. Mr. Armstrong unsuccessfully argued in the state courts the same arguments that he made in the district court and then that are made before this court. All of his claims have been fully exhausted. But it is significant in one respect, with respect to the polygraph argument that Mr. Armstrong is making, that there is one argument missing from this federal habeas corpus action that was before the state court. This court asked during Ms. Kujalski's argument what difference it made, in a sense, that the confession of Jeremy Armstrong was admitted at trial after a proceeding at which Mr. Armstrong contends he was unconstitutionally prevented from introducing polygraph evidence on a question of whether or not, during an interrogation, a police officer had put his hands on Mr. Armstrong, an issue on which Armstrong and the police officer differed. The circuit court on the pretrial suppression motion found the police officer's testimony credible and found that there had been no actual physical coercion. It was on that issue that Mr. Armstrong wished to introduce polygraph evidence. This court fairly asked if it made a difference. Was there not other evidence? Yes, there were other witnesses, and most significantly, Mr. Armstrong himself testified at his trial to the facts I have already described, that there was a plan to rob, that the plan was being enacted, and that during that plan, when the victim tried to defend himself, Mr. Armstrong closed his eyes, fired the gun, and caused the death of Mr. Drury, and then later came back and completed the theft by taking the money he had forgotten in the aftermath of the shooting. So Mr. Armstrong did himself testify at trial in his own defense to the facts that demonstrate what a serious degree of crime was committed here. When the jury was given an opportunity to determine whether it was first degree felony murder, a lesser offense, or first degree reckless homicide, they chose first degree reckless homicide. There is no question that there was a killing here. There was no question that what was the subject of the confession was in fact introduced at trial through the testimony of Mr. Armstrong himself. Moreover, I would point out the missing argument from this proceeding that I alluded to that was present in the state court is whether the confession of Mr. Armstrong was voluntary. Mr. Armstrong contended in the state court that his confession was not voluntary because of, he alleged, there was physical coercion. That argument was rejected in the state courts and on direct appeal. It is not before this court. It is not being pursued in this habeas proceeding. So we have a voluntary confession for all legal purposes here, but more importantly and moreover, the testimony of Mr. Armstrong himself at his trial as to what happened. We think under the circumstances, both that there is no basis for the defendant's, for Mr. Armstrong rather's claim that the ruling of the state courts on the exclusion of the polygraph evidence, there is no basis for his claim that that ruling was contrary to or an unreasonable application of any controlling United States Supreme Court precedent. We think, frankly, it turns the Sheffer case on its head to claim that a Supreme Court holding that there is no constitutional violation to a per se rule excluding polygraph evidence, that a state court ruling that precludes polygraph evidence in a criminal case under a state court rule that creates a per se rule on the exclusion of polygraph evidence in criminal cases, we see no basis under Sheffer for concluding that the state's rule is anything other than totally consistent with the Sheffer case. Moreover, for the reasons I've already described, I think it's perfectly clear that this controversy over the confession is one that is not of great consequence in this case. The very subject matter of the confession were matters that were acknowledged by the defendant in his own trial testimony. Turning to the issue of the self-defense instruction, we think it was perfectly clear that there was no basis under Wisconsin law, under law that is consistent with principles announced by the United States Supreme Court on a defendant's entitlement to a lesser included instruction or to a defensive instruction, that there was no sufficient factual basis in this case for the giving of an actual self-defense instruction, what is referred to by the parties in their arguments as the perfect defense of self-defense, a complete defense of self-defense, and secondly, that there was no right, as Mr. Armstrong claims, to a instruction on the imperfect right of self-defense, that an instruction that would have said under Wisconsin's homicide law that a first degree and intentional killing committed with a mitigating circumstance of what the law refers to as imperfect self-defense reduces the degree of the crime. The state courts held that in either event, with respect to either claim, there was no reasonable basis in the evidence for a notion of self-defense, simply because under well-established Wisconsin law, as I believe the court's questions have already clearly pointed out, it was Mr. Armstrong who was the attacker. It was Mr. Drury, the murder victim, who was the victim. It was Mr. Drury who was acting in self-defense. In the flurry of activity that was set into motion by Mr. Armstrong pulling a gun, threatening to shoot, and demanding money from Mr. Drury, there was not a point at which Mr. Armstrong became the victim of anything. He was the aggressor. He was the attacker. Mr. Drury lunged at the gun to protect himself. An attacker cannot, under those circumstances, reasonably, under the law of Wisconsin or under the law of any other jurisdiction that we're aware of, claim the right to self-defense, either perfect self-defense or imperfect. Finally, Your Honors, with respect to the question of the constitutionality of the juvenile statutes, I think we have fully explored this matter, and I think the parties have fully explored it in their briefs. I would simply point out this in response to the Mr. Armstrong's argument about an irrebuttable presumption. The fact that the statute, the Wisconsin legislature, has deemed that there are circumstances in which a person convicted as an adult may nonetheless be sentenced or as a juvenile or receive, in the terminology of Wisconsin, a juvenile disposition. The fact that there are circumstances, the legislature has said, in which that can occur, and that those circumstances have been set according to a consistent, according to a set of criteria that may be difficult to meet, does hardly represent or hardly demonstrates the creation of an irrebuttable presumption. In essence, I think what the Wisconsin legislature has determined is that a juvenile who commits an adult crime, who is prosecuted as an adult and is convicted as an adult, may, under very limited circumstances, still receive treatment as a juvenile in terms of disposition, but the circumstances under which that event will occur will be extremely limited. We don't think there's an irrebuttable presumption here that raises a due process problem. We simply believe the legislature created a very limited set of circumstances and they were not satisfied here. For all of these reasons, we believe that the district court properly denied Mr. Armstrong's petition for a writ of habeas corpus.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you have anything for Mr. Chelsea?
Our concern and the reason for attempting to bring the polygraph evidence into evidence at the suppression hearing was because we were upset about the way that Jeremy Armstrong was treated by the detective. Again, you have a 15-year-old. He comes to court. He claims that these things were done to him and that that is the reason that he has been coerced into making a statement. There was no videotape of the confession. There was nothing else to corroborate his view of what happened, his story of what happened, except for the polygraph evidence. We were not allowed to present it at the suppression hearing. Additionally, as the state points out, yes, Mr. Armstrong testified at trial. However, he was impeached with statements that he had made to the police, so the fact that the confession still came in was important. He claimed self-defense at the time of the trial, and he was impeached by some of the statements that he made to the police officers. Finally, as the self-defense issue, we acknowledge that Jeremy Armstrong did admit that he pulled a weapon on Robert Drury. Again, the evidence of the history between Mr. Drury and Mr. Armstrong was admitted at trial. It showed that Jeremy Armstrong was afraid, and we continue to maintain that he had a right to self-defense. For all of these reasons, we ask this court to reverse the decision of the district court and find that the state court decisions were contrary to United States Supreme Court precedent. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Were you retained counsel?
No problem.
Well, we appreciate your efforts for your client. Thanks very much. Case will be taken under advisement.